Today's sermon is going to be a little different. We're going to look at prophecy, and prophetic things are obviously a little trickier. We're going to look at one of the most pivotal prophecies in the Bible today, the 70 weeks prophecy. And the goal of this sermon is so that at the end we'll know a little more about prophecy. We'll be a little better able to handle future events. And there are other prophecies, of course, we'll look at too in time as we compare events with the prophetic framework that we have. And of course, one thing I always believe, stay flexible, because God is going to surprise us in something. But also, this sermon is just one of many proofs of the Bible. If someone were to say, you know, someone who was really, let's say, from the worldly academic approach, well, this is just the ideas of one ancient nation, the Hebrew nation. Tell me how this book can be proven to be true. And, of course, the Jews have been scattered around the world and all their biblical books, and they've kept them punctiliously. And yet, books like Daniel have predicted the future, and it came true. I mean, just as a thought, you realize that Daniel predicted four major world ruling empires. It's actually worked out that way. The last one, the Holy Roman Empire, like long legs, going down to the end time with the ten nations. Isn't it interesting that as we're close to the end, Europe is trying to unite? I mean, politically, militarily. You know, as we talked about before, Ireland sabotaged the last election a couple weeks ago. The Irish said no. And the other European countries, they've worked it out now where the people don't get to vote on treaties. But Ireland is part of their constitution because they felt they were tricked by the English in previous years. And that, whether that's true or not, I guess it's a debatable topic. But the Irish voters are suspicious. They have to approve every treaty. And it seems like Europe cannot be united in a secular way apart from religion. And I know Europe is waiting for the religious leader and the great political leader to come on the scene. So let's look at one of the well-known prophecies that proves the Bible, the 70 weeks prophecy. And at the end, I think we'll understand it better. Hopefully, it'll help us to try to remain faithful and unflappable in future events as we approach the end time. Now, Daniel 9, Daniel gives a tremendous prayer where he's in sackcloth and ashes. And I'm assuming he wants to be sure that God is going to let his people go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their nation and come out of captivity and maybe even make it better and sooner than expected. And he goes to Jeremiah and he finds the 70 weeks prophecy and he bases his prayer on that. And of course, the big story is that one of the top three archangels has to fight his way to Daniel inside the Babylonian Empire and give him the answer. But what's interesting, he doesn't just answer the question, you know, when and will the Jewish people get to go back? He gives him a much more comprehensive prophecy that goes all the way to the end, to the fulfilling of all prophecies. The famous 70 weeks prophecy, because Daniel was a man much beloved, he got more than he asked for. So we're going to pick it up in Daniel 9:23. Daniel 9:23, at the beginning of your supplications, because Daniel had been fasting for 3 weeks, commandment came forth. I'm come to show you, for you are greatly beloved, therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. 70 weeks are determined upon your people. By the way, the word weeks in Hebrew could just mean sevens. It's one of those language things. And so it doesn't have to just mean weeks. It could just mean 70 sevens. Are determined upon your people and upon the holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make a reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up vision and prophecy. Now, that's a whole mouthful. So let's break down verse 24 and look at all the items that this prophecy is going to cover. First of all, it's your people, which would be the house of Judah, which is roughly three tribes of Israel, mostly Benjamin, Judah, and Levi, and a few others that came with them as God blessed them more than the others. The holy city. The holy city is always Jerusalem. And the key is this prophecy is going to be about the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Now, let's look at the items he mentioned, and then we'll take a look and see if they've been fulfilled even to this date. Number one, finished transgression. You know, that means the finished with the world of sin means a new world order. Number two, an end to sin. Again, a new spiritual order before you reach that level. Number three, make atonement for iniquity. Well, that has been done because Jesus Christ came and at the stake or styros, he paid the penalty for sin. Number three. Number four, bring in everlasting righteousness. It's going to last forever. Obviously, that's a new government. Number five, to seal up the vision and prophecy, like a final prophecy to kind of link them all together and fulfill the all of them. And number six, anoint the holy place. That is the Holy of Holies or the holy place in the temple, to dedicate it or rededicate it. So let's cycle back through the six and see which of these have been fulfilled already, because there's that duality in prophecy. It's like part of it's fulfilled, but not all of it. We're going to look at the part that's been fulfilled and how exacting it came out. Number one, finished transgressions. Obviously, that hasn't been done, right? No. Number two, end of sin. Obviously, that hasn't been done. There's plenty of sin out there. Number three, matter of fact, I just heard today someone was stabbed, I think, to death in the Olympics, a coach's close relative in China. And they're fighting some kind of war right at this moment. It's escalating in Georgia and Russia. Georgia's where Stalin's from. There's some part of Georgia that wants to break away from Russia. Everybody wants to get away. But they've historically been part of Russia for many years. And I guess the central government's not going to have it. So I don't know any details because our press doesn't give us much coverage of world events. They're too much focused on celebrities, much I said. America needs to, if you watch the BBC, you get a much better world view, at least in that context. Number four, so there's plenty of bad things going on in the world. Bring in everlasting righteousness. That's a new government that's going to, and without new government, the world is never going to have everlasting righteousness. So needless to say, that's not there. Number five, to seal up vision and prophecy. Well, the final prophecies haven't been fulfilled yet. Number six, to anoint the holy place. Actually, the temple and the holy place don't even exist. So by implication, I personally believe they will rebuild it. We'll speculate about that a little bit. They will rebuild the temple and the holy place to dedicate it or rededicate it. So when is all this going to happen? This is maybe one of the values as far as proving the Bible of the 70 weeks prophecy. Verse 25, Daniel 9, verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem, and not to build the temple, but Jerusalem, because there are some different dates when you get into the temple, to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks, 62 weeks, the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. Now, the numbers may get hard to visualize, but I'll run through them real quick. We'll probably put this up on the website, too, the article with the numbers on them. But Artaxerxes made a decree, 457 B.C., and there are a number of key scholars that back that date, 457 B.C., the Jews were having trouble trying to get back in various political infightings, and he finally gave them the legal authority to rebuild Jerusalem and to secure the walls. Because in those days, a major city wasn't secure unless you had walls to secure you from your enemies, vandals, thieves, and whatever, and to secure the walls. And what we have is 62 plus 7 is 69 weeks. plus the final week, the 70th week. Well, if we take these as sevens and not weeks, and each day for a year, which is often the case in Bible prophecy, then it's 69 times 7, 483 years. Now, there's one final week left. We'll talk about the final week, the last of the 70th weeks in a minute. That's 69 times 7, 483 years. If you subtract 483 from 457, remember that in B.C. you count down instead of up because they rearranged the calendar to build around the birth of Christ. So you're counting down. And, you know, B.C. stands for before Christ, and A.D., the years of our Lord, you know, Latin. Although some people want to get rid of that because they want to get religion out of the calendar, too. They want to get rid of the B.C. and A.D., but that's another story. They're trying to kick God out of everything, even the calendar. But it's still there. What you come to is 26 A.D., but you have to have 1 year for zero. If you think about it, you move the zero on one end, you have a zero on the other end. So you got to add 1 year because you got the zero. That's 27 A.D. Guess when Jesus Christ started his ministry? 27 A.D., the coming of the Messiah. And some will say, well, the Jews must have just kept going back into the book of Daniel and changing it. But remember, the Jews don't believe in the first coming of Jesus Christ. There's no way that they would change their scrolls to reflect the birth of Jesus Christ. Plus, the book of Daniel has tremendous details about the king of the north and the king of the south. When you apply it to the history of the Ptolemies and the others, it's accurate up to a certain point till the Roman Empire comes in the story. And then it kind of ends, and it goes to the end time, which is yet to happen. And that kind of accuracy, nearly five centuries ahead of time, there's no way that the Jews could have predicted that. It could only have been known by the God who's in heaven, who controls events. And granted, Satan would have loved to have changed it if he could, but he can't. So, I mean, the 70 weeks prophecy is just one proof. Now, to add to that, we got the half week, 3.5 years. 27 A.D., 3.5 years, you come to 31 A.D. That's when Christ made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And it's really interesting. He planned it all. They even had a little colt that Christ said has been set aside for me. And he rides into Jerusalem. Some people call it Palm Sunday, however you want to look at it. By the way, that's the day the Jews normally would get the lambs that maybe one or two family or three families are going to eat, and they set it aside to get it ready to be butchered. They didn't have refrigeration like today. They'd butcher it some hours before the Passover and roast it, the whole thing, and then go into the days of unleavened bread. Christ, of course, was fulfilling. He was the true lamb of Passover. I realize the Passover is, you know, the death angel passed over the people of Israel in Egypt. But the truth is, that's just a model of God passing over our sins. The Jews will understand that in the future when all that's explained. Just a few interesting tidbits on that. People throw palm leaves and the cloaks and other things, and Christ rides into Jerusalem, and they start hailing him and praising him. And prior to that, Christ would never allow the people to openly say in a big crowd that he was the Messiah. He would tell them, just keep it quiet, or he performed miracles. Don't tell anybody. Not that that worked, but he often even run away from the crowds. But now that he's coming to Jerusalem to fulfill prophecy, he openly tells them, some of the Pharisees complain about the praise he's getting as Messiah. He said, if they didn't praise me, the very rocks would cry out. So God is fulfilling prophecy, and Jesus came to Jerusalem to fulfill that prophecy. He also was crucified in the middle of the week. You know, he's cut off in the middle of this last week, 3.5 years. Wednesday is the middle of the week. And God does things methodically. That way you allow for 3 days till the late in the Sabbath for him to be resurrected. That's zero count when you count to 50. And then Sunday, the wave sheaf offering, he goes back to his father. In the meantime, he gets, you know, I'm the first fruits, and he's blessed. And the wave sheaf offering is blessed by the priest. That's day one. And then you you know, 7 times 7, you come to 50 Pentecost. We know most of that, but I just want to review it so we can see how it all fits together neatly. One writer I read, he said that possibly the 490 years punishment on Israel, you know, the 70 times 7, is possibly because of all the land Sabbaths they didn't keep. Or maybe because of all the regular Sabbaths that they polluted with idolatry and broke. But whatever the reasons, we know that they were in captivity because of sin and because of mostly idolatry and Sabbath breaking and mixing the truth of God with a lot of pagan things. So that when Elijah spoke to them, they actually didn't know who was the true God. Was it Baal? Or the L-O-R-D is the Hebrew name for God, which is probably Yahweh, Yahweh, Jehovah, or however exactly. We don't know the exact phonetic sound of it, but we know how it's spelled. Which God it was, the God of Israel, or was it Baal and all those pagans? They actually didn't know. They were confused. And of course, Elijah does a tremendous miracle of the God burning the sacrifice to show the people which is which. By the way, even after that, Jezebel's army chased him, and except for 7,000 people, the northern 10 tribes did not repent from their idolatry. And they went into captivity earlier because of that and because of their false religion. Unlike Judah, they were never able to have systematic repentances, etc. Let's go on to verse 26 in Daniel 9. Verse 26, because these verses are very rich with key details. Daniel 9, 26. And after 62 weeks, shall the Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. Now, he's cut off in the middle of that last week, but not for himself. He actually, and by the way, cut off, from what I've been told by someone who I believe is an expert, the Hebrew word means it's not an accidental death, it's an execution from some judicial decision. In other words, some court, some authorities said you should be cut off. And of course, Christ was cut off, but not for himself. He died because of all of us. By the way, there are people who will say, the Jews killed Christ. That really is not true. The Jews don't like Christ. That isn't true. Christ was very, very popular. He had to run from crowds. And several times they wanted to put him on their shoulders and march to Jerusalem and make him king. He had to, you know, get out of the crowds and hide. It was the religious leaders who didn't like Christ because of jealousy. And you know how power and jealousy are. Because he didn't support them. And maybe that's a whole other story of their self-righteousness and their misunderstanding. Although later, when we get into the book of Acts, we'll see some Pharisees did later convert to Christianity. So some of what he told them, it got through to some of them eventually. But even some of top position. He shall be cut off, but not for himself. Everybody, the reason Christ died, was cut off, was because of all of us. Everybody. Not just the Jewish people, as some will tell you. But he died for everybody's sin. He died for my sin. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, a prince did come. That was Titus. And he did destroy the city and the sanctuary. Actually, they totally destroyed the temple, maybe leaving one or two walls left. That's the Wailing Wall now. But they actually, the Romans planted salt in parts of the area around Jerusalem. According to some writers, that was called the land of milk and honey, as you remember, as the Israelites entered. You look at the Middle East now. I know the Jews have improved it some. But you look at it, would you ever think of that as a land of milk and honey? When the Romans got through with Judah, and of course most of the people were hauled off into slavery or killed, it was a total destruction, a total disaster. So then there'll be a flood. Now, that prince, Titus was, he was soon to inherit the emperorship of the Holy Roman Empire. I think it was actually called the Roman Empire then. Later, it got the title of the Holy Roman Empire when it combined with the church. But do you realize that I think that a prince like that will come in the very end time? We'll talk about that in a second. That's also part of the prophecy. You see, what happened is, at the point where Christ was cut off, it's 31 AD, and we can clearly see that Daniel, nearly five centuries or five and a half centuries ahead of time, he knew Christ's first coming. Now the prophecy shifts down to a second coming. It's like God put a pause button. 3.5 years of that last week, you know, the 69 weeks, then 3.5 years, and all of a sudden God pushes a pause button, which has gone over 1,900 years before we fulfill that last 3.5 years. We're going to speculate a little bit about the last 3.5 years. What's going to happen? What does it mean? And by the way, remember that prophecy is dual. Often you have models, like a scale model, then the fulfillment. And sometimes you even have several scale models, like Antiochus Epiphany is a smaller model of the beast. He tried to destroy the Jewish people. He was the first one to set up the abomination of desolation in the Jewish temple. What he did was he took a pig, which, of course, that's abomination of the Jewish people, to sacrifice on the altar, and then he put a statue of Olympus, Jupiter, in their most holy place. And, of course, it was the Judas Maccabeus led a Jewish revolution a while later to cleanse the temple and retake it. And that is, of course, Hanukkah. That's where the Jews get Hanukkah from. And the oil lasted several days while he rescued and cleaned up the temple. Maybe that's a model of what will happen again in the future. And, of course, Titus was a model when he destroyed the temple. And I think Adolf Hitler is also a small model of the beast in modern time. We'll finish reading verse 26 and verse 27. Verse 26. Shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, like a flood of armies. And unto the end of the war, desolation are determined. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, that as many people will become Christians and will get the new covenant and be on our way to being baby gods. And we'll be reading about that in our Bible study in the book of Acts. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of the abomination, he shall make it desolate. Even unto the consummation that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. In other words, it's going to happen again. It's going to be very dramatic. And Christ mentions that in Matthew 24, the abomination of desolation is one of the triggers that you know the end time and his second coming is close. So, I believe the temple will be built again in this end-time temple. Let's speculate for a minute. And I'm just going to speculate. Let's say if someone in Europe becomes a great military hero and he unites Europe. By the way, it may not have to be 10 kings. Sometimes numbers, and a lot of what's in Revelation is symbolic, like poetry. Certain numbers are symbolic, like 7, 10, 40. I'm not saying it isn't 10 kings. Or it could be 10 kings, but more than 10 nations. Like the Austro-Hungarian Empire at one time had one king. And that, you know, when his son got shot, and that was the trigger for World War I, as you might remember. Well, that kingdom actually controlled Austria, Hungary, I think parts of what are Czechoslovakia today, Yugoslavia, and a few other parts of Eastern Europe. So all those countries could be in under one king. I mean, it's a possibility. And who knows, maybe even the Tsar will come back in Russia. There are pretenders to all those thrones in Europe. They don't have much power, but it's possible. You can still have 10 kings and more than 10 nations. There are probably several other combinations that are possible. But this is going to be a big Europe. Bigger and militarily more significant than the United States of America. And I know that may not look very likely now, but you can tell America's strain militarily. And of course, if we're just speculating, maybe America will no longer be the stabilizer of the world. Maybe America will be in the back burner or even worse things when we get to the end time. But it will be Europe that will be the the big military power on the planet. And this leader is a great military hero. And he says, I'm going to do what nobody else could do. I'm going to bring peace to the Middle East. And whatever the dealings are, and he'll put a big army in there and he'll make the Palestinians and others behave and cooperate or intimidate them or make a deal, you know, whatever it is, and put a big army around that part of the world, make a treaty with the Jews. And some people imply that some of these words in here imply the Jews will make some kind of deal with this man of sin. One thing that Israel has always done, has been part of their strategy, they've always had one great sponsor, I mean the nation of Israel in the Middle East. There was a time when it was Britain and America, but lately it's been just America. We've been their big sponsor. Those of you might remember the Yom Kippur War when they were attacked during while they were all fasting, and the Egyptians had, at least for a while, broke through and were making a lot more success than anybody had expected. And, you know, being a small nation, they were somewhat threatened. They lost a lot of tanks, and I won't go into all the details, but it was the United States that came through with emergency air resupply of Egypt with new American tanks and jets, which were actually better than anything they got from the Russians. And, of course, the Jews are good generals and good fighters. They turned the tide, rolled back the Egyptians, and actually were in a position to even surround Cairo when they made the deal. But if it weren't for one great sponsor, Israel could not survive. Well, if America declines, for whatever reasons, and I'm not saying I know, just speculating here, or we withdraw, become isolationists, whatever, Israel might say, well, the only great power left is in Europe. And they make a deal with this guy in Europe. And he does the unthinkable. He brings peace to the Middle East. He tells the Jews, build your temple. And they build a temple on the Temple Mound. Now, maybe they leave the Dome of the Rock there and they're both there. Or they get rid of the Dome of the Rock because he says you can do it. And there's the Jewish temple. And they're starting the sacrifices and all that. And everybody's praising this man who, see, we think the beast will look like a villain. But the world won't see his villainy until near the end. You realize Adolf Hitler was Man of the Year in Time magazine in 1939. He had, except for Winston Churchill, he had a lot of people deceived. They thought he wasn't so bad. I mean, you know, we might laugh at that today, but I'm just that, you know, as a model, it gives you something to think about. He'll come in peace, build a temple, protect it. Then suddenly, his armies will turn instead of facing outward to protect the Jews from the Palestinians and other Arab nations. They'll turn inward and come toward Jerusalem. And the way it's described in Matthew 24, if you want to be taken prisoner, don't go back and pack your bags. Just get for safety quickly, implying that those armies are going to move so fast you may have only a day or so to get out of there and it's too late. And they're quickly, you know, like lightning war, before you know it, they're in there. They take over the temple, and they do the abomination of desolation all over again. And here's the part that's hard for me to believe, but I know it's written, so I know it's true. The man of sin will actually go to the Holy of Holies, probably have international television on him, and he'll sit on some kind of throne in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God, and he will be acknowledged and worshipped by the whole world. Now, we all know Protestants know better than that. I have a hard time understanding how it's going to happen, but somehow these churches will be overthrown, apostatized, deceived. One thing I can think of, if someone had told me the worldwide Church of God, with all the knowledge it had, would someday, at least a big chunk of it, apostatize, where they're farther left than the average Southern Baptist, I would have said, you're kidding me. But I live to see it. So people can be deceived, even people who know better. So the great pause button is on. Let's go to Luke 4. We'll just talk about the great pause button. And there are many prophecies you can look at where the prophecy goes so far, and then it's fulfilled, but then the rest of it is an end-time prophecy. Like we'll see the prophecy about Joel. We'll see that in our Bible study. And you'll notice that all those people getting God's Holy Spirit at Pentecost was the first fulfillment, but the final fulfillment of Joel's prophecy doesn't really come to the end time. Like, God put a pause button in the middle of the prophecy. Anyway, let's just look at this one. Luke 4, verse 17. There was delivered unto him, this is Christ, the book of Isaiah. And when he opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, the recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And he closed the book, and he gave it again to the minister and sat down. All eyes of them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began to say unto them, "This day is that scripture fulfilled in your ears." In other words, he said the first coming of the Messiah, which that prophecy talked about, is here, and here I am. And of course, they were shocked. But if you read those prophecies, you will see that those prophecies also include the second coming. Like, God put a pause button. The first one was coming was there, but the rest of it, and Christ stopped like in the middle of it. And if you go through and read Isaiah 61, 1 through 3, or Isaiah 9, 1 through 7, you'll see it's like Christ stopped in the middle, closed, like, just closed up the scroll. I guess it was a scroll, you roll it up, and didn't finish the rest of it. So God can put a pause on a prophecy. It goes so far. And the pig and the idol in the temple is upcoming, and so I believe it's a temple. I know you could argue, well, couldn't the Jews just set up a tabernacle tent if they were to find the that little Ark of the Covenant and just start sacrificing? Of course they could. But why would the man of sin, a great European emperor, want to go to a tent? And that temple was a fabulous temple. And apparently it had gold weaving into the metal. And when the sun set and rose, it was in a high point in Jerusalem. It just glowed. And it's going to be Jerusalem is kind of the center of the world. It will be the top religious point. And this man who wants to be worshipped as God will want to be there. That's why I think it will be a temple. So I think the final real beast and false prophet are coming. We have to be flexible and understanding, not get locked in. Because if we get locked into some perspective, it's a little different than we think, we might miss it. We won't see the incoming events. We won't be inspired to get more and more spiritual and stay faithful. Because we have to stay faithful in a very tricky world. And I think God will help us if we are open-minded and study prophecy. Because that's why it's there. When the final 3.5 years of Christ's ministry and events take place, the question is, when will those final 3.5 years be fulfilled? One writer said the apostles finished it up to about Stephen's martyr. And I would say that's probably a small type. And they did great miracles. We'll be reading about those in our Bible study. Others say the last 3.5 years of the church, probably being led by the two witnesses, will be the final fulfillment of that. Or the first 3.5 years of the millennium. And if that's the case, the church is going to do some fabulous things the last 3.5 years before Christ's return. Now, some will say, why didn't God just not have the pause button on there? So we know exactly when the end time is coming. I think God doesn't give us that because he doesn't. Because if we knew the exact date and we knew it was, say, 12 years from now, I'm not saying it is 12 years, but if it was 12, wouldn't we be lulled? You'd say, I'm going to sin and just be bad. And you know, about maybe 1.5 years before the date, then I'll get spiritual. Right? And I don't hope this doesn't, I'm not scaring anybody. But you realize I could have a heart attack next year. This could be my end. I need to stay up spiritually. You're thinking, not me, but a lot of people that I know younger than I am have suddenly died of heart attacks. I could tell you stories. It's scary. Or you could get hit by a Peterbilt truck next week. I'm not trying to scare you, but I'm saying no one knows. You don't know. So you have, God wants us to stay motivated. Note that this final prince will demand worship. Let me tell you a little story about Adolf Hitler, if he's a small model of it. In 1928, even though the Nazi Party had a ton of publicity from his trial and all that, they only got 2 to 3% of the German vote. Then there was the Great Depression, because American money really helped Germany a lot. And we have the Great Depression. Germany was the worst hit of any nation during the modern nation during the Great Depression. After that, Hitler's vote went up to about a third of the vote, and he was one of the major, his party, the Nazi Party, National Socialist Party, was one of the leaders in the German Reichsmark as far as votes. And he was made, 1933, he became prime minister. And then Hindenburg died, and he combined both offices. Let me give you part of the story that you might find interesting. The Nazi Party had their own private army led by Ernst Röhm. They called them stormtroopers. Mostly they wore brown shirts, although they had some special guards with black uniforms and the skull on it, the SS, and Hitler had his own private little guard as well. But most of them were brown shirts, and they went all around Germany fighting with the communists and fighting with the other social democratic parties and any opposition and terrorizing Jews. And when Hitler got to power, the regular German army said, we don't like the prime minister having his own private army. We are the only army in Germany. If you want our support, you got to get rid of those guys. And Ernst Röhm thought, well, I helped you, Hitler, fight your way through the streets of Munich and all those other places. I should maybe be head of the army. Of course, the army had their own ideas. Hitler made a deal. He assassinated Ernst Röhm one night. He made a deal with the German army, and it went something like this. If the army will pledge allegiance to me personally, that's Adolf Hitler, personally, I'll disband my private army. And there are, you can see them on the newsreels, all the German units with their big flags, laying them down in front of Hitler as if worshiping. And all the officers, they hail Hitler, and they all had a little pledge where they pledged personally to Adolf Hitler. As he says, Hitler is Deutschland, and Deutschland is Hitler, and they pray, personal pledge to him, personally. Do you realize that Adolf Hitler was inspired by the devil? It was like they're pledging allegiance to the devil. Don't you see a small model of the man of sin? Now, maybe the details will be different in the final, and this guy may be smoother than Hitler, more clever, and same with his religious leader. But the whole world is going to stand there in some way, pledge personal allegiance to the great dictator, the beast power. And God calls him the beast because he's an evil beast, but the world won't see him that way probably until the last minute when maybe they'll finally see him. One more thing. I'm reading this book about the start of World War II, and a lot of it's dull stuff, but on the eve of the war, Hitler cut himself off and sent all his diplomats away from all their key posts like Paris, Warsaw, London, and said, don't take any communications. The Poles were probably going to concede the Danzig corridor to Germany, which he was demanding. He didn't want them to concede. He wanted war. Actually, he had more than that in mind. He wanted to really conquer all of Poland and all of Eastern Europe. And I thought to myself, if you're looking at it from one point of view, if the devil went to all that trouble to give Hitler that power, he wasn't going to let mankind off without a horrible, blood-curdling war that would kill 35 to 70 million people, depending on whose count you take, because it was so out of control, no one's quite sure. The final beast will be that kind of evil man. Let's go to Revelation 12 and look at the beast a little bit for a few minutes as we close the topic, and just be thinking about what is yet to happen in the future. Somewhere down the road, watch Europe. I'm sure the beast will be from Central Europe somewhere. France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Romania, Switzerland. One of those countries, I believe. We'll have to wait and see, I guess. Revelation 12. Let's start in verse 13 and 16 of Revelation 12. A little bit about what happens to the church. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. In other words, the woman is the church. Christ is going to marry the church. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into wilderness into a place where she is nourished. By the way, Israel left on two eagle's wings. That's just figurative language. It doesn't mean we're going to fly anywhere. We may walk somewhere, whatever God decides. where she is nourished for times, times, and half a time. Is that 3.5 years again? The last half of that week. From the face of the serpent. So the serpent isn't going to be too happy because the church will get away from him. So some of the church will be protected for 3.5 years. Revelation 13, verse 4. And they worship the dragon. You know, the dragon is symbolic for the devil. Which gave power unto the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? He'll be a great military hero of some sort. Verse 5. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, like he's God. How blasphemous can you be? Blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. That's again 3.5 years. Let's move on to verse 8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him. And that word all is kind of stunning. And I don't know, how is that possible? And I just don't know how it's possible, but probably in some way, shape, or form, all the churches, and I will admit it's hard to believe it, and will give some level of allegiance to this man. I mean, the devil will see to it. How, I can't imagine, because you're going to think, well, don't all the good Baptists know better than that? They do now, but in the future, will they? And I have no idea, but it does say all. And when we get through context, all except for God's church. But all the others. And it's hard to believe. Whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. Verse 11. And I beheld another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Now, in symbol, lamb means Christ, innocent, Christ-like. And the dragon is the devil. In other words, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. It's someone who will really be a dragon, be very devilish, but he'll appear to people Christ-like, a false Christ. Before the real Christ, there'll be a false Christ. He'll be so spiritual. I mean, that's the way he'll be perceived. And, you know, probably good PR people, good media manipulation. People will worship this man, and so doing, they'll be worshiping the devil through that man who pretends to be Christ. Verse 14, and deceives them that dwell on the earth. He's going to deceive everybody except the church. By means of those miracles which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth, that they should make an image to the beast, which had a wound by a sword and did live. So the false religious leader, who's Christ-like, is going to say, this man was wounded, he's a great hero, you should worship him. He had power to give life unto the image of the beast. I'm not sure what that means. Will it be talking statues? You know, there are churches now where people go all kinds of weird things because somebody says they saw a statue bleeding or doing something. Maybe these statues will talk. I'm not saying that's what it means. It may be symbolic for something else. We'll have to wait and see, but it'll be interesting. Image of the beast should speak. And cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast that should be killed. Now think about that. Remember the three Jewish lads in the book of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's a great song too, which I love that with the bass quartet. But anyway, they were told to publicly worship this golden image, which I assume was Nebuchadnezzar, and that's a type of the beast, the whole system. They refused to do it. And God saved them, as he will save some of us. But I believe it's a public thing, not a private, secret thing. That someone secretly stamps the symbol on your hand, and, or they force you to take it, and therefore you're going to get persecuted by God. No, it's a public deception where you buy into a religious system, including worshiping a false god, a man. You go the whole way. So don't worry about it. It was my postal symbol. I can't get mail from the post office. And it's not your social security card. It's not any secret where they're going to sneak up and hit you with it. You don't know what it is. It's something you do publicly and willingly. And it's caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand and their forehead. And I think the forehead means the mind. They think it. and the hand is the economic, you know, the work part of it. Though no man might buy or sell, save he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man, and the number is 666. 666. Nero's name, and you know in Latin and Greek, the letters can also be numbers. Nero's name, he's also probably a model of the beast too, in a way. Crazy guy. 666. Okay. But probably, so what will happen is the name of the beast will be on us. Just like the German army had the name of Hitler, they worked for Hitler, they worshipped Hitler, they had a personal allegiance. Like in the American army, when they commission you, you're commissioned by the Congress of the United States. It's not to any man and the Constitution. But you see how that's much different than being belonging to a man. Well, people will publicly say they belong to this man and give him allegiance. It's not something that can be forced on you. It has to be voluntary. Those of us who know the truth will be faithful. And some of us will be protected, like those three young lads. Or some of us will be heroic martyrs like Stephen. But most of all, we should be faithful. Remain faithful. And if we do, we'll become baby gods and rule with Jesus Christ. Thank you.